Welcome to Addiction and the Family, episode 52, from a life of addiction to a life of service. How has addiction affected your family?
It robbed me of my father.
Addiction's affected my family in absolutely every way.
It has caused a lot of turmoil.
It goes back to what I understand is at least three generations.
It robbed my daughter of her mother. It robbed my mother of her daughter.
Addiction has made our family quite challenging.
Addiction affected my family tremendously.
It's affected my relationship with my sister, where I'd go for months without talking to her.
It's a very difficult thing for everybody involved. It doesn't just affect the one individual. It's a disease that affects the whole family.
Addiction has spread not only genetically through like some of my relatives and I assume ancestors.
It's generational.
I think of him every day.
Welcome to Addiction in the Family, a podcast by and for family members of anyone with any addiction. My name is Casey Arriaga, and I'm a clinical social worker and addiction counselor at both Windmill Wellness Ranch and Recovery Tree Counseling. And I'm the author of Realistic Hope, The Family Survival Guide to Facing Alcoholism and Other Addictions, Spirituality for People Who Hate Spirituality, and my children's book, Mommy's Getting Sober. My wife, Kira, and I were in our addictions for over 10 years together and have shared recovery for over twice that long. Join us as we offer experience, strength, and realistic hope about how you and your family can find recovery together. In this episode, we talk with Melissa, who's lived with addiction for all of her life, first through her family, then in herself, and now as someone on the front lines of helping others to find the recovery she feels blessed to have gotten herself. She talks about family patterns, how she embraced them for years, and how she's now helping to change them in her own family and in the lives of so many others. All this and more after a break to hear from one of our sponsors. Addiction in the Family is brought to you in part by the generous support of Windmill Wellness Ranch, an innovative treatment center located in the beautiful hill country of Texas and serving clients and their families from throughout the United States.
I'm Shannon Mollish, CEO of Windmill Wellness Ranch. We offer the best in neurotechnology to heal the brain and the best therapy to heal the mind. Call us today at 210-762-6217.
I'd also like to let you know that Windmill Wellness Ranch now has a free course available to any family or friends of anybody with any addiction. The course is available at windmillfamilycourse.com. Once you go and sign up for free, you'll get a weekly email pointing you towards blog posts, videos, and podcast episodes that help carry a message of hope. Sign up today at windmillfamilycourse.com. Welcome back. Without further ado, let's hear our interview. So welcome to the show. And would you like to take just a moment and introduce yourself and tell our audience, what are you doing on a show called Addiction and the Family?
My name is Melissa. I am doing this because I believe that addiction affects not only the person that is struggling with the disease of addiction, but everybody else in their life.
Absolutely. Has addiction affected your life before you got into addiction?
Yes, absolutely. I come from a long line of alcoholics, some addicts, a lot of mental health. My grandparents on my paternal side, my dad, all my dad's brothers struggle with the disease of addiction as well. Mom's side of the family, more probably prescription drugs and probably marijuana, just long line of addicts and alcoholics.
In my experience, that's going to really affect the family dynamic, how people interact with each other, how they talk to each other, just sort of the emotional feel of the household. And is there anything that you remember about that kind of impact for you?
Absolutely. I remember being very little and always being scared or always feeling like you had to walk on eggshells, didn't want to cause any additional upset. You just always knew when my dad came home, if the door slammed just a little harder than normal, that there was probably going to be some sort of upset that night, which typically meant that he was drinking prior to coming home from work. There was a lot of domestic violence growing up as well, all fueled by alcohol, all of it, every time.
I'm really sorry to hear that. And I know the kind of impression that can give somebody of the world, of relationships, of themselves. And are you aware of how that might have impacted you and the way you saw yourself and relationships in the world?
Of course. I mean, I see it now. I didn't see it when I started to develop relationships with anybody. It always seemed to end up that I gravitated towards somebody who drank, somebody who was violent. That was probably my young adult life growing up, was typically choosing men that were alcoholics and violent. Why that is, I don't know, but that's how it worked out. Maybe if I think about it a little bit more, which I've thought about a lot and talked about a lot in therapy, is that was pretty comfortable. That was kind of a norm. That was what I was used to. I didn't really know, or was it modeled for me, what a healthy, productive, kind of team-oriented relationship was about.
Yeah, and I've often said that if we have unresolved trauma, there's a part of us that always wants to return to the scene of the crime, so to speak, whether it's gravitating toward the particular place. But as you say, I find a lot of times gravitating towards relationships that, to some extent, feel comfortable because at least I know who I am in this relationship. Even if it's uncomfortable, I know what to do.
Yep, absolutely.
And that is a sort of comfort.
It sure is, and it sure was.
And I would say there's another piece, though, that sometimes maybe I feel like I want to see if I can get it right this time, if I can resolve it this time. Sort of like, I couldn't save Dad, or I couldn't get his approval, so I'll pick somebody like him and see if I can save them or get their approval.
Absolutely.
Did you ever notice anything like that in yourself?
For sure I did. That happened often, thinking that you could get into the relationship with somebody and you could make them change. Or if you did things a certain way, they would love you enough to where they wouldn't continue with the drinking or continue with the abuse, which was never the case.
But there's a third factor, I think, that often comes into this. And I remember this from some of my early relationships, which was that due to the, not just the things that happened, but my impression and what I took away from those things left me with a pretty low self-image. And so I thought, consciously or not, somebody healthy isn't really going to want to be with me. And I don't know what I would do in a relationship with them. But if I'm with somebody who's not healthy, well, if I put up with their stuff, maybe they'll put up with my stuff. And that became part of the dynamic. And of course, this was always unspoken. I can't think of any relationship where I said, well, hey, I'll put up with your BS if you put up with mine.
Right.
But that is kind of how it went.
That is exactly how it went. It's so different to be in a relationship that you can actually communicate with somebody and really start to feel comfortable enough to really express how you're feeling, or if you were hurt, or if you're happy about something, or that you talk about someone and they're not jealous about you talking about someone. I mean, it was foreign at first for me and very uncomfortable.
I think that last part's really important. Can you talk a little bit about that discomfort?
Yes, absolutely. I find when I was in those relationships that were so, so unhealthy, and then coming into a relationship and bringing my behavior, bringing my part into this so-called healthy relationship, it wasn't going to be tolerated. It was like voiced that this is not a good way for us to be, and we need to change this, and let's work together to make this better. And that was very strange to me. I didn't understand what my role would be. It was an unfamiliar role for me.
Yeah, and that's a really important point. Just the unfamiliarity. You know, research shows that certainly throughout the mammal kingdom, all the way down to mice, will return to an uncomfortable or even dangerous situation if it's what they know. Like if home base is something that is uncomfortable and possibly dangerous, and we get startled, we'll still run back to home base.
I would have to agree with that. For sure.
And I think that internally, we can do that. The home base doesn't have to be a physical place. Now, it doesn't even have to be one particular person, but it can be that sense of, again, this is the kind of relationship that I know. And it's important just in hearing your story to recognize that that's not just about, this is the area I grew up in, or this is the kind of relationship that I watched. But as family members, it's the kind of relationship we participate in. You weren't just watching relationships that seemed dysfunctional between the adults, although that sounds like that was certainly the case. But you also participate in your own way, like you said, walking on eggshells or don't upset someone. And that can become the model. And interestingly enough, people can go to one side of that dynamic or the other, or maybe even flip back and forth. Sometimes I will be tiptoeing. Sometimes I want to be the one who's tiptoed around. Maybe I'll be the loud one. Maybe I'll be the angry one for a change and kind of try and take a piece of that power. And I wonder, what was that like for you?
I have three brothers and a sister. So we all kind of stuck to our own roles, I guess you could say. My role started out as like sick child. Like I was sick a lot when I was little. My little brother was kind of the funny guy, always laughing. My older brother, he's disabled. And then my oldest sister and brother, they tried to leave the house as soon as they possibly could, which they did at like 16 and 17 years old. So it was just my younger brother, me, and my older brother. And we pretty much clung to one another in that kind of environment. Yeah.
How does it feel to look at that today?
It kind of makes me a little sad. But as I look, I don't see that any of my siblings are really in that kind, not that I'm aware of. I don't have a very good relationship with my oldest two siblings, but I don't think they're in violent relationships. I hope they're not. I mean, everybody, all relationships have struggle. We know that, but I don't think it was the degree that we grew up with at all.
I'm really glad to hear that.
Yeah, me too. I know that there's still some drinking with a couple of my siblings, and all I do is I pray. I pray one day they'll find some peace.
Yeah. When you were growing up, did anybody talk about the addiction? Did anyone acknowledge what was happening?
No. Nope. Nope. Nobody ever did. Even when situations became where other family members were involved, like my grandparents, I can remember them coming to the house when I was little and my dad was being taken away to jail. I remember both sets of my grandparents, my dad's parents and my mom's parents being there. That's how bad it was. But then it was never talked about again. Never. It wasn't even talked about years later with my grandparents or anything. As I grew up and became a young adult, my mom and I talked quite a bit about it, especially after being in domestic violent relationships myself. Her and I have talked about it a lot.
I love that you've been able to do that. But as a kid, when you were experiencing that, this thing that can define a family system, and yet no one's talking about it, what did that say to you?
Said that it was okay. Made it seem like that kind of behavior, that kind of violence, that kind of secrecy, that was how it is. You didn't talk about it. It wasn't okay to talk about it. Lots of family secrets.
Yeah, and if somebody's in a situation where it seems like it's whatever is happening, you just know on a gut level it's not okay, but everyone's acting like it's okay, then one of the most logical reactions in the world is to look at that and say, well, then maybe it's me. Maybe I'm the problem. Everybody else seems okay with it.
Yep.
And especially as a child, that can be a very literally surreal experience. And I know as a teenager, I really got into surrealist art. And it took me years to recognize that one of the features of that art style is that really odd things are happening and everybody's pretending like it's okay. And as a teenager, I knew in my own household growing up where addiction was a central feature, I knew that just on a gut level, you can't talk about it. And so we all had to pretend like it was okay. And I didn't make that connection that that's why I liked that art style. But I look back now, just even as we're talking, and think like, wow, yeah, no wonder. So now as we kind of move through your story, you mentioned at the top that addiction has been a part of your own personal experience. We can say, okay, due to this childhood, certainly put you at much greater risk. Sounds like there were some genetic precursors. When did it actually start to enter as something that you were involved in?
Probably around maybe age 12 or 13. I probably didn't recognize it, but I knew that what I was doing was excessive. The drinking, the staying out, hanging out with older people. 12, 13-year-old girls shouldn't be hanging out with people that are 18 and 19 years old and drinking and partying at all. And probably around age maybe 14 or 15 is when I really realized that, wow, I probably have some issues with something, but just escaped in drugs and alcohol.
What was it like to recognize that?
Well, to recognize it or to notice it or to be aware of it, those are probably not accurate terms. It was like maybe a fleeting thought of, wow, you might have a problem with this. Oh, well, continue on. I probably didn't really recognize that I had a problem with anything until I was probably well in my 30s.
I'd say similar for me. It wasn't till age 30 when I went to go see a therapist who said, hey, have you ever heard of sex addiction? And I was like, no. But now that you say it out loud, funny, I had noticed that I hung out with a lot of people who had issues with addiction, some of whom were recovery, some of whom went in and out of recovery, some of whom were clearly not in recovery and needed to be. Never occurred to me that I was drawn to that crowd because I belonged with them. I was just thought like, oh no, I'm just smarter, cooler, faster, better than everybody else. They may have issues, but oh, that's not me. And I think growing up around it had an influence on that. I don't know about you, but when I grew up, I told myself, well, I'm not going to do that until I did.
Oh yeah. I'll never do that. I'll never be in a relationship where there's violence. I'll never drink like that. I can handle it. Yeah. I stopped drinking alcohol. I stopped drinking completely when I was 24, but I didn't stop doing other things. But I stopped drinking, and it wasn't because I thought I had a problem. It was somebody else who told me, you got a problem and you need to stop or else we're not going to be able to continue on in this relationship. And but for the grace of God, I was able to stop. But like I said, I didn't stop using other substances. I was still escaping. I was still escaping my life. I was still trying to escape me.
That's a really profound thing to say.
Yeah.
I think that's such an important thing for, especially on a program for family members, for people to be able to hear that, that, you know, this isn't just about looking for a party or a good time. But for those of us who get really serious with it, we're on a serious mission.
Yes.
And I think you just named it.
I think, Casey, when people are in their addiction, family members think, what did I do? How did I cause this? Or what can I do to help? Or they almost try to take on the blame or try to fix the situation. And it's like, this, it's internal. This isn't about anybody else in my life. It's about me. And I think when a person makes that connection, that this really is me, that's scary to realize that you have been trying for years to escape yourself.
We can't run that far from ourselves. We can try, but I don't know. It's like trying to outrun your shadow. Mm-hmm. It's not going anywhere.
It's not going anywhere. And I think sometimes I was so afraid to voice to anybody how bad of a struggle it was or how big of a problem it was out of fear of the people that I loved leaving, you know, reaching out for help and them saying, well, I don't know how to help you. This ain't my problem. This is your problem. Which that was not even the case at all whatsoever, but it's just that fear.
Yeah, it's funny that fear often gets us into the addiction, fear that I'm not good enough, that no one will want me, that I can't stand being me. But it's often also a measure of fear that gets us out of it.
Yes.
Or at least gets us looking at it and then eventually gets us motivated. Because the kind of experience that you're describing where even as a kid at points you thought like, well, this might be a problem. And then we'd brush it aside. And then later in life, we'd go, yeah, this might be a problem. Or someone says, hey, this is a problem. And you still brush it aside. One day, the day comes where we can't brush it aside.
Yep.
I've often said, I think that's really the process of hitting bottom, which for some people happens multiple times on the way down, kind of like tumbling down a staircase. And some people hit something profound at some point, say, yep, that's it right there.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people, it might be a little bit of a mix of the two. And go through various moments where we have the thought, we push it back out of our minds, we have it again later, we push it back out until we can't anymore.
Yeah.
And if you're comfortable with it, would you mind talking about what made you think, okay, never mind, I'm getting into recovery?
Well, my house was raided by three different law enforcement agencies because they had been following me for almost 3 years. Because I was selling a lot of methamphetamines. So that was kind of a wake-up call that, wow, this might really be a problem. It was that event that shook me to say, wow, people know you have a problem. You have a problem. You know you have a problem. But the addiction, the obsession, everything they talk about, I even used after getting busted. And I can remember coming home one night and it was late. And I remember having the very same thought the night before I got busted of, I don't want to live this life anymore. I don't want to live anymore. And I had that very same feeling. And I went home and I got online and I started to look for a place, because I think it wasn't the addiction that was scaring me anymore. It was the fear of me wanting to take my own life that really brought me into recovery. Because I knew that I had a problem. I knew I was driving down the same road, having the very same thought. And I thought, this is insane. This is insane. And it's got to stop. Didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew I had to take a step towards that.
Well, needless to say, I am so grateful that you did.
I am too. And you know what? I can honestly say that I haven't stopped moving forward since, because I don't ever want to go back there. I don't ever, ever want to have those kinds of thoughts again.
So powerful. And that seems like a good place to take a quick break and hear from one of our sponsors. And then when we come back, we'll continue the conversation.
In early recovery, it's all about building those patterns of trust, and SoberLink is here to help. Picture this: instant alcohol test results that pave the way for open and honest communication. SoberLink's advanced reporting keeps you in the loop every step of the way, with detailed client reports that highlight patterns, progress, and areas for support. This isn't just about monitoring, it's about reinforcing trust through consistency and transparency. SoberLink comes packed with features that make rebuilding trust seamless. Daily scheduled tests for routine, portable devices for freedom, built-in facial recognition, and tamper sensors for credibility. Every feature is designed with one goal in mind: to keep you connected and supportive. Be a part of their success story. Head over to www.soberlink.com/family. There's a $50 off promo waiting for you to help the person you care about most on their path to a brighter, sober future.
Welcome back. So we'll pick our conversation up, and we're talking about the phenomenon of hitting bottom.
The moment does not come at any point where anyone from the outside could say, well, surely that must be it. But inside, we say, surely this must be it. I can't keep doing this anymore. I've often said, you know, family members go through the same thing. They may be doing all kinds of behaviors themselves that may not seem addictive, but we can act like we're addicted to our loved ones and addicted to saving them from their own behavior, addicted to giving money, even though we know where the money's really going, but we're not being honest with ourselves. But somewhere in there, family members often also hit bottom, to be able to say, I can't keep going like this. But for the person with the addiction, when we hit that point of, I can't keep going, and the two options are either I get into recovery, which sounds often really scary and unappealing, but the other option is I'm going to have to end my own life. That's the only other way out. Then we're really at a crossroads, and you headed in the direction of recovery. Let's talk about that. What did that look like for you?
Well, I thought that I would be going to a fancy place like Malibu or Passages or some kind of fancy resort place, because, you know, I didn't have any idea what recovery was. I knew people that had been to treatment, but I also saw that treatment didn't work for them people. My dad went to treatment a couple times. My husband had went to treatment a couple times. And I just saw that, yeah, they still do that. But I ended up going to a place that was right not far from my home, went to a very brief, I think it was not quite 4 weeks of treatment, but the way that treatment was set up, the aftercare, I think is really what kept me engaged. And I had a lot of family support. My husband was very supportive. My husband went to meetings with me. I had to do weekly UAs. Of course, when your house gets raided and they seize all your property, you don't have a vehicle to drive. So we had one vehicle to drive, so he did drive me. And really, I was fearful of being out in public after my house being raided. But his support, my mom's support, my siblings. And you know, when the cops raid your house, all those people that you thought were your friends that you were running and partying with, they kind of disperse quite rapidly. And they don't resurface, which made it a lot easier for me to continue on the road of recovery as well. So I definitely had to change my people, places, and things, and that all fell into place pretty easy.
You know, there's that expression that some people use in recovery of a higher power doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. And I hear that a couple times in your story, even just so far, with the thought of like, I can't keep going like that. And then somebody raised your house, or three agencies raised your house. And then later you're saying, well, I can't run with these people anymore. But, you know, you just mentioned the people that were looking for a party. You know, a lot of parties get broken up when the cops show up. So, man, there you go. It worked out for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. It worked out pretty well. You know, we talk about a higher power in recovery, in seeking that out. But for me to seek that connection, or a reconnection, however you want to say it, has been so profound in my life and has done nothing but grown day in and day out. That is truly where I find peace, is when I'm involved in meditating on God's word, honestly.
So I'd love to talk more about your journey of recovery, because so many people, when they tell their story of addiction, you know, we hear a whole bunch about the addiction part. And then the recovery part is kind of like, well, you know, then I got into recovery. You know, it's been great ever since. But I think it's really important for ourselves, for other people listening who need hope, and for family members to hear, what does recovery look like? And can you talk a little bit about your journey from that early stage, going to treatment, just getting out, doing the aftercare, to some of what's led to what your life looks like today?
Well, I knew that when I went to treatment, I thought that I heard a message that nobody else had ever heard before. That's how naive I was to recovery. I heard a message of hope, and I wanted to carry that message to other people. I chose to get an education on how to do that, to get my LCDC license. I started working in a treatment facility that I absolutely love, and I've worked there for over 7 years. And I can honestly say that I have been in treatment for almost 8 years now. And I love it. Not necessarily the job itself, but the people that I work with who are also in recovery and who are on the same path show me ways that I didn't know. They guide me when I need guidance. They help me with direction. It's profound, the people that are in recovery, what they are willing to do for you. And all you have to do is ask. I mean, do I work a perfect program of recovery? No. Do I go to meetings all the time like I should? No. Do I stay connected to my higher power? Absolutely. Do I reach out for help when I need help? Absolutely. Do I let people know when I'm struggling? Absolutely. Absolutely, I do. For me, it's about being honest of where my thoughts are, my words, my actions, being conscious of myself, as opposed to wanting to escape myself.
Beautiful. Let's take another quick break, hear from one of our sponsors, and then when we come back, we'll have the conclusion of our interview with Melissa. Among our sponsors, the most important one is you. We are so grateful for your support in our mission to help people with addiction and their families find recovery. Here are some ways you can help. I have a website at caseyauthor.com where you can find all the various ways I am working to spread a message of hope for anyone struggling with addiction and anyone who loves them. There you can find videos, interviews I've given on other people's podcasts, information on my books, Realistic Hope, The Family Survival Guide for Facing Alcoholism and Other Addictions, Spirituality for People Who Hate Spirituality, and my newest book, Mommy's Getting Sober, a children's book that also includes a guide for caregivers on how to talk to kids about addiction. All three are available on Amazon and other retailers as both paperback and ebook. If you have read them, please tell a friend or anyone you think might be helped by their message. There's also a link to help support us on Patreon.com. Your subscriptions help make all this possible. If you'd like to become a subscriber, visit Patreon.com and look up Addiction and the Family. Thanks again. We couldn't do this without you. Welcome back. All right, let's hear the conclusion of our interview with Melissa. So we talked a lot about family relationships and how they were impacted by addiction growing up. Let's talk about family relationships and how they've been impacted by recovery.
The one thing that comes to my mind is I have some teenage nieces. I don't have children of my own, but I have nieces who are aware that I had a drinking problem and that I had a drug problem. And to be able to talk openly with them And for them to be able to talk openly with me, especially about what they're experiencing in their young lives, or about what their friends are experiencing in their young lives, and not just about addiction, but about mental health as well. I think that's one of the most beautiful things. And another thing is the way that communication with my husband and all my family members, there's no secrets anymore.
Well, that's really profound, because I don't know all the detail here, of course, but I'm going to make an educated guess that when you're doing the kind of stuff that gets your house raided, you're probably not being super open with what's going on in your life with your family and the people around you.
No, not at all. It was quite a shock for a lot of my family members.
And I know when I got sober, I had family members and friends openly challenge me. Oh, you're not addicted. It's not that bad. Because I knew how to make it look good on the outside. And I had grown up around secrets, so secrecy just became a way of life for me. And similar to what you're saying, recovery has become a life of not just honesty, like if you ask me the right question, I'll tell you the truth, but candor, where the people who need to know something, I try and make sure they know it.
Yes.
And that speaks to the kind of transformation that we go through in recovery. And it sounds like you have.
I hope so. I sure hope so.
Well, it sounds pretty evident in the things that you're saying, just the way you're talking about it here.
When I talk about guidance from others, I mean real guidance from other people. And I don't mean people just telling you what you should do. I mean people sharing their experience with you and how they got through it, and never telling you, well, this is what you have to do. This is what you should do. It's just simply, this is what I did, and this is how I got here. I think that's what the program of recovery, why it can be so attractive to other people, is because it's not a, you have to do this, this, and this, or you're not going to succeed. It's just the sharing of their experience is what helps guide the next person.
That is a really important point. And of note, you're doing that right now. I notice you're not lecturing any of our listeners on what they need to do, but you are talking about what you've done and what worked for you. And it's been said that one of the founders of AA, Bill W., was struggling trying to get other people to embrace this solution that he felt like he had found. And he was kind of complaining about this to this doctor that had worked with him a lot, a guy by the name of Dr. Silkworth. And the story, at least as I heard it, was that Bill W. was complaining about this, and the doctor said, Bill, stop telling people what to do. Just tell them what you did.
Yep.
And my understanding, at least makes a good story, is that one of the next people he did that with was a guy by the name of Dr. Bob.
Yep.
And the two of them ended up forming Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yes.
All just based on that idea. I'm not going to tell you what to do. I'll just tell you what I did. So if you don't mind, maybe talk a little bit about some of the things that you did that led to the life you have now.
Well, I definitely followed directions. I followed and kind of modeled what other people were doing. And did it always feel comfortable? And did it always feel okay? No, it didn't. Did I like calling a sponsor and talking to some strange person about my life? No. But did I do it? Yes, I did. Do I share my experience with other people? Yes, I do. That not only helps them sometimes, but it definitely helps me. I try to go to meetings. I really just try to help carry the message. And really what I try to do these days is I try to fight the fight so people have the same option to go to treatment and to start their journey with a solid foundation, just like I was able to do.
It's so powerful.
Because care is out there. I don't think everybody knows that it's out there.
It's absolutely true. And one of the many things that is important to publicize is that help is available in many different forms. There are meetings of many kinds, and we talk about that on this program, 12-step meetings, smart recovery meetings, celebrate recovery meetings, Life Ring secular sobriety meetings, women for sobriety meetings. There's many, many varieties. So if anybody says, well, I went to some meeting and I didn't like it, pick a different one. There's plenty of options. But there's a lot of options for treatment as well. I'm going to speak with some insider knowledge and say you happen to work at one of the top treatment centers in the country, which probably means in the world, and you're a really important part of that.
Yeah, I love my job. It's not a job. It's not work. It's a passion that I want people to know that there's hope and there are people that will fight for you to obtain that hope. We're on the front line of this battle against the disease of addiction every day. And it's a battle. My hope is that when my time comes, that God will say, "Well done, my faithful servant. I want to be one of God's warriors on the front line of this battle." Because it's a soul sickness. It's a spirit sickness.
Well, I happen to know that you are doing that.
I know you are too.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I think one of the last things I want to ask in this interview is, looking back where we started in your childhood to where you are now, if you could go back and say something to that little girl who was living in that household, what would you want to tell her?
It's going to be okay. You're going to be okay. You will survive this. Yeah, you will survive and you will thrive.
It's really beautiful. And are there any last things that you want to say to any family members out there or anybody else listening to this broadcast?
Yeah, I would like families to know that their person in their life that's struggling is not trying to escape them. They're just trying to escape themselves. Just help them find a place to escape to so they can recover. It's hard, but it's possible.
If you'd like, do you want to say where it is that you work and tell people where they can find help?
Yes, I work at Windmill Wellness Ranch, located in Canyon Lake, Texas. It is one of the top, if not the top, treatment facility in the nation. Might be, like you said, in the world. And please, please get yourself some help, because it is out there. And a life in recovery is far better than life of misery living in addiction.
Well, ain't that the truth?
Yes.
Melissa, thank you so much for coming and joining us today, and I'd love to have you back sometime.
Absolutely. Anytime, Casey.
Thanks for being with us through another episode of Addiction and the Family. As they say in many recovery meetings, take what you liked and leave the rest. Go out and explore the possibilities for recovery in your life and give your loved ones the space and dignity to make their own choices. If you liked this podcast, please subscribe. It means a lot to us. If you know anyone else who could use what we have to offer, please tell them about Addiction to the Family. If you have comments about this podcast, have a question you'd like to answer on the show, or want to contribute your voice, or just want to say hi, you can write to us at addictionandthefamily@gmail.com. We're also happy to be your friend on Facebook, and we can be found tweeting on Twitter.
Addiction and the Family is produced, written, and engineered by Kira and Casey Arriaga, with music by Casey.